accession number 18802, reel 21.
Brigadier Cowan, reel 21. You were telling me about your living arrangements. Mm.
And I take it you were asking about Jennifer and me personally rather than the battalion. There was a commanding officer's house, but it, as often happens on these occasions, it was being refurbished or wasn't ready or something. So we were put in a flat to start with. And then we moved into a very nice house, sort of typical stone, very deep stone house, stone floors and everything, and very typical of the area.
What about the battalion? Were they? Were you in?
We're in a perfectly ordinary barracks. Perfectly ordinary barracks, parade ground in the middle, and all that sort of thing, and everybody was very comfortable.
Was this in near Medina or Valletta or?
No, it was down the road from Valletta on the coast. And I absolutely forget the name of the place, but I think it was roughly St. Andrews.
What were you doing while you were there? What were your activities?
Well, mainly training, and, you know, general training of the sort that I was describing just now.
Individual, collective,
individual, collective, cadres, that sort of thing. The second in command and the quartermaster and I did a recce to Libya, where there was a training area for collective training in the desert, and that was all right. In fact, we didn't go there in my time, but it was all set up, ready to go.
Was there a British staff there to look after you?
There was a headquarters in headquarters Tripoli. And they were accustomed to visiting battalions passing through.
Had you done any desert warfare training before?
I don't think so, no. But the training area was such that although desert warfare could be practiced, it could also be adapted for ordinary other terrain, and it wasn't a problem at all. You could just do training as in a general sense. So we were doing that. We were trying to get involved with the local population in Malta. We quite certainly set out to study the siege of Malta. And we did that in the form of study days with officers and NCOs. And we involved local population in that. And that was very popular indeed, both with the locals and with our own people, because it gave us something specific to get our teeth into about our local surroundings, as far as we were concerned. And as far as the locals were concerned, they were thrilled to bits that people like us were trying to do something interesting from their point of view. And that was a great success. I don't think there's much more to say about it than that.
What level of training could you do in Malta? It's a small island. Did you have any sort of training areas on which you could do tactical training up to company level, battalion level?
No, I think it was all pretty individual. I'm sure there was a training area, but I just can't remember where it was or what size it was. But any battalion training, and I think company training as well, had to wait for Libya.
And you didn't go on that one?
No, I wasn't there long enough for it to start.
Did you have good ranges on Malta?
Yes. If you asked me to describe them in detail, I couldn't. But certainly shooting was a priority. You asked what else we were doing. One of the things I was told on arrival was we'd better get a polo team. There was a General Frost, who was the GOC, who was a great, and a cavalryman, who was the number two, whose name has just slipped out of my head, but it'll come back. And they were both great polo people, and they said, Malta, one of the things about Malta is polo. And I suppose going back to Mountbatten and before and all that. Anyway, I said, well, I'm not aware I have any polo players in my lot, thank you very much. But they said, well, have a try. And so we called for some volunteers, and we actually got some volunteers who said they'd like to learn polo, about three or four of them, and not all officers. And so anyway, we set out to have a polo team, but it never happened in my time, and I rather suspect it was just a passing thing, and that people were quite keen to do their horse riding, but they didn't particularly want to go on with polo. But it was quite a novel thought for a rather steady old infantry battalion.
The idea of other ranks polo is also a little peculiar.
Yes. Oh, I think it was only one or possibly two, but it was interesting that they should want to.
It's generally reckoned to be a fairly expensive game to play. Do you have any recollection of how it was going to be financed?
I think it was subsidised by the GOC, if I remember correctly.
Apart from
in fact, it would have to be.
It would have to be, yes. Apart from polo, what other recreational activities were available in Malta?
I suppose about everything is the answer to that. Mm. Certainly football and cricket and hockey, tennis, all the usual things. I don't remember golf, but I suppose there probably was some. One other sidetrack thing we got involved with was HMS Tiger, because HMS Tiger was affiliated to the Tigers, or the Tigers were affiliated to HMS Tiger, whichever way you like to put it. And she was a very senior ship in those days, a cruiser from memory. And, you know, one of the ships of the Royal Navy at that particular time, and to be the commanding officer of Tiger was reckoned to be, you know, you were an up-and-coming admiral, as it were. Sadly, the man blotted his copy. He was, I'm told, very well thought of, but he blotted his copybook because I think it was a visit to Portsmouth or Plymouth or somewhere. He happened to let off the main armament by chance, and that, I think, was the end of his career.
That sounds rather careless.
It sounds very careless. But we had a wonderful day because, well, wonderful two or three days, actually, because they came ashore and we looked after them and sort of, you know, inter-service sports of one sort or another. And they looked after us when we went aboard and had a wonderful day with them. But my conclusion from it all was, thank God I'm an infantryman, not a sailor.
Why was that?
I don't know. It was just a feeling I got. I think I got a feeling that they were much more formal than we were. Much more, if one used the word martinet, I suppose that's talking rather more about the personality of the individual commanding officer. But I got a definite feeling that we ran on a much more relaxed basis than they ran. And my upbringing being such, I reckon that's more effective.
Perhaps naval discipline has to be more formal in view of the sort of operations they conduct.
Could well be. Could well be.
And also they're in a more confined space, aren't they?
Yes. And indeed, I mean, I had always, as a small boy, I wanted to go into the Navy. And I can remember being desperately upset and sad when I discovered I was colorblind and couldn't go into the Navy at the age of 11 or something. But looking back on it now and having seen what I saw, I'm very glad I was in the Army because I think I was more suited to it and it to me.
You mentioned that the Maltese were very pleased that you showed an interest in the Great Siege. How did you get them involved in it? Did you get them involved as commentators or participants in your exploration of these operations?
Well, I really can't remember in detail, because I can't remember who we got involved, but there were several people who... first of all, quite a lot of people were aware we were doing it. There were two sisters, the Mrs. Strickland, who were very well-known names in Malta. One of them owned the local paper, and I think, you know, the family had been almost Mr. and Mrs. Malta for years. And somehow or other, my mother knew one of them. And so, you know, we sort of got involved on the fringes with them. We got involved on the fringes with the commanding officer of the local TA unit.
Would that be the Malta Artillery?
Yes. There's a man called von Brockdorff.
Von Brockdorff?
Yes.
That doesn't sound very Maltese.
Well, he's a Count. Count von Brockdorff. Known as Brocky. And we got to know him quite well. And, you know, one thing led to another, and there were a number of people who we consulted about how we were going to set about this thing. And I think on the day, one or two people turned up, but it's just a general impression that they were pleased we were doing what we were doing.
What about other connections with the local population? Did you get on, did the soldiers and you get on with them well, or were there any causes of friction?
Don't remember any friction. I suppose there must have been some. There usually is in a garrison town of some sort.
Well, that's common old garden stuff, isn't it, really? But I'm thinking sort of going beyond the normal frictions that
don't
one
think
expects.
So. No, I don't remember it. Mm. But then again, I was there a very short time. I mean, hardly enough for friction to show.
So, I mean, there already by that time there were the stirrings of a movement for independence and for removal of the British presence. Do you remember seeing anything of that?
Yes, I remember being aware of it. I can't remember the names of the two contenders for the post of Prime Minister, one of whom was pro-Brit and one of whom was anti-Brit. And I cannot remember their exact planks and so on. Yes, I was aware there was a problem or a potential problem, but it certainly didn't strike us in terms of animosity to soldiers.
What about the atmosphere when you were in Libya? Did you get any sense there of the political atmosphere in that country?
Absolutely none at all. I went to the headquarters, Libya. We drove out to the training area. We spent a night in the training area, drove back to headquarters, Libya, and back to Malta. That's literally all I did, 24 hours.
So it was all over too quickly.
And I saw, I mean, apart from seeing the requirements of the training area, what we needed to take, what we needed to do, and so on, I absolutely know nothing about Libya at all.
Moving on to your next posting, the one out to Malaysia, as GSO1 of the 17th Division, how did you get to Malaysia from Malta?
We came back to England.
You came back to England.
And I can't remember how long we were here for, but a short time. And then I flew out, and then Jennifer followed a short time afterwards.
Where was the headquarters of the 17th Division?
My mind has gone utterly blank. The state was Negri Sembilan. That's the capital city of Negri Sembilan, and the name has gone absolutely out of my head. It'll come back as we talk.
What was the division doing? What was its
well, it had been involved in confrontation in Borneo, and so it had been away, in Borneo. It was commanded by a gentleman called Pat Patterson, who sadly has now died, who was a Gurkha by upbringing. And I will merely say that two things, a sort of general introduction to it all. My predecessor at G1, who'd been in Borneo with the confrontation lot, he said, "Now you'll have to find out quickly what's going on here, because," he said, "the general wants to have a study period, and he wants to have it in his house, and he wants it to be joint service, all three services. And he said the subject is counter-revolutionary warfare." And so I said, "What the hell is that?" And so he said, "Well, I can't tell you, but the general will." And so that was a very good introduction to all this. And so anyway, I trotted along and said, "Hey, what's counter-revolutionary warfare? And I gather you want a study period in your house." And he said, "Yes to all that." He told me what counter-revolutionary warfare was in his book. And so we duly had a study period, which was called Cry Havoc. And I think we had three study periods from memory, and one exercise with troops, which was, I mean, on a divisional level, which was interesting. I mean, it was Commonwealth Brigade, Commando Brigade, yes, two brigades, that's right. But the net result of all this is that he said the general said he wasn't interested in what you might call the ordinary continental warfare and so on. He said he was interested in Chinese methods of conducting warfare and methods of the Australian methods mainly of competing against them. And we set out, having had the study period, we set out, the G2 and I, G2 being a Royal Marine, we set out to do a crosstalk presentation to do to all and sundry who came to visit the place, and the Army Commander got it, the Commander-in-Chief got it, visiting Secretaries of State got it, etc., etc. And people joining the division got it. But the long and the short of it was this man, Pat Patterson, single-handed as a major general, changed the entire slant of training in the Far East. And I found that a fascinating concept. And it wasn't just for the Army, but the Far East fleet came along with it and the RAF came along with it. I'm not sure the latter two actually understood quite what he was getting at. Quite a lot of the soldiery probably didn't quite understand what he was getting at, but the fact is, it changed, and it was a very interesting business.
You're saying then there was a shift from conventional warfare towards irregular operations and counterinsurgency throughout the whole theatre?
Yes. When I say single-handed, he changed the slant of training. I can remember Mike Carver, who was the Commander-in-Chief at the time, when we'd finished this presentation to him, he said words to the effect, "Well, Alan, I'll buy some of it, but not all of it." And I'm not sure he really sort of was converted, and I'm not sure the Army commander was converted. But as far as the troops on the ground were concerned, the Gurkha Brigade, the Commando Brigade, the Commonwealth Brigade, all adopted this new form of training. And therefore, to me, that means the shape of training in the Far East changed, even although some of the old and bold weren't necessarily converted to it. And it was very much based on the Australian methods in Vietnam. which of course we weren't allowed to visit. So we had to get it second hand from the Australians.
Did you have Australians in the Commonwealth Brigade?
Yes. There was an Australian battalion.
Were they a useful source of...
Yes. And there was a New Zealand battalion as well.
What then are the distinctive features of this Australian approach to counter-revolutionary warfare?
Well,
how did it differ from what we'd been doing in Malaya earlier, for example?
I'm not sure. It didn't differ significantly. There was just more of it. And whereas I think in Malaya, it had very much been on a... not quite sure what the right word I'm seeking for is. It had been very much on a company and lower deployment basis. This was on the basis that... and also, just before leaving the Malaya thing, I don't think people were talking in terms of what was going on the anti-terrorist side of Malaya. I don't think we're necessarily saying, well, this is how we'd deal with the Chinese or the Japanese or whoever if there happened to be a conventional war of some sort. I think people were much more thinking in terms of, let's call it old-fashioned continental type war. Whereas this particular system was saying, look, forget all about the continental type war. We're looking at the Chinese way of infiltration, attack, and so on, and we're looking at ways of parrying that, but not just on a company basis and a distended basis, but on a concentrated basis as well, and looking, still connecting up with the Malaya side of things, very much on the hearts and minds aspect of it all. And saying that, you know, what matters is that side of it, and that you can really forget the conventional way of lining forces up against each other. I haven't put that at all well. But I think it became so ingrained in all of us that we didn't regard it as odd, and therefore we didn't regard it as something that needed to be sort of thought about specially. We just thought, well, you know, this is how it's going to be.
Where do you think Patterson had got this idea that all warfare in future was to be conducted on this basis?
I really don't know, because I don't think he was a great reader. I don't think he was a great intellect. He was a very good trainer, and indeed he finished up as Director of Army Training in the end, which I think is probably the only job in the ministry he could possibly have done without loathing every minute of it. But I think he read a certain amount about the Chinese. I think he talked to a lot of Australians. And somehow it all just evolved. But how it evolved, I really can't tell you.
You mentioned about the Australians being active in Vietnam. Was there an acute awareness of what was going on in Vietnam at the time when you were in Malaya?
Yes. And we were very sad we couldn't go and look for ourselves. But, you know, politically it was verboten, and that was that. And so we very much relied on reading Australian pamphlets, which we used, and talking to Australians about it. And I suppose when you were saying, you know, what was different and so on, I suppose when I was talking about hearts and minds and so on, I suppose in the back of my mind I had, you know, these great American artillery and air bombardments in Vietnam.
The use of fire bases.
Use of fire bases and so on, which, you know, apparently weren't achieving anything. And so I think we were looking for different ways of doing it.
Do you remember if you ever studied the methods used by the American, the US Marine Corps?
No, I don't. And I think probably the answer is no, we didn't.
How did the troops respond to this drive to adopt this Australian method?
I suppose with interest is the answer to that. And on the whole, I mean, soldiers will respond to anything if it seems to make sense. On the one hand, they will respond, in my humble opinion, to new ideas, although, you know, we're always told we're a very conservative lot with a small c. My experience is that people will respond to new ideas, and particularly if they seem to make sense. And these sort of ideas did seem to go down well with the soldiers. I think perhaps because there were Gurkhas around, I suspect they find it perhaps easier than the rest of the mob did. But I think they all thought, well, you know, let's give it a go. Let's see how it all works out.
What about the commandos? Because their role really is normally one of amphibious assault, isn't it? Which is a fairly formal sort of operation.
Yes. I mean, they were just looking. This is an intellectual exercise, I suppose. I mean, they took part just the same as everybody else did, because they were, you know, one of the brigades in the division. But no, I mean, nobody in their senses would be trying to convert them from their proper role. But they were employed at this particular time as infantry, and therefore they went along with everybody else's systems.
What was the internal security situation in Malaysia like at that time when you joined the division? Was there any notion that there was a threat at any level?
I don't remember there being any notion of a threat. Mind you, the confrontation had only finished relatively just before I got there, and so I suppose in the back of one's mind that existed. But as far as the mainland was concerned, I don't remember there being any threat of any sort.
Did you have any connection with the Malaysian armed forces?
Very much on the fringes. I mean, we met them from time to time, but I don't remember doing any joint exercises with them.
Did this shift in the style of training and its purposes impose a great deal of work on you as the...
Yes, huge amount. I mean, to such an extent that I've got family connections in Australia. And also New Zealand, if it comes to that. But I was very keen to go to Australia and see some of these people. And the first year that I was in Malaysia, we were absolutely flat out on, you know, producing the paperwork for all these exercises and so on. I mean, it was very hard work indeed. And so I said to Jennifer, we'll go our second year. And unfortunately, there wasn't a second year. She came home to do something with the children. And while she was at home, I was posted to the MOD after only a year in the job, which was very sad.
Had you managed to actually complete the job of converting the training program?
Yes.
By that stage?
Yes. That was all done, but, you know, from a personal point of view, I'd like to have enjoyed life for my second year and travelled a bit and relaxed a bit.
Were you doing this work mainly on your own, or were you working as the leader of a team when you were?
Leader of a team.
Yeah.
Fortunately, the